out of his mouth. You're going to make it, George. You know, everybody that comes up to introduce somebody says it's such an honor and a privilege to introduce the speaker. And I must say, it truly is an honor and a privilege to introduce Vivian to you guys. Vivian walks the walk. And you can see the results. You can see that this program works in Vivian. You know, she's been wonderful. And most of our girls, or many of our girls that make it back, go back to Hilton Head from here, she's taken under her wing and been such a great friend too. She's going to tell you what she used to be like, what happened, and what she's like now. I've had the privilege of getting to know some of what she's like now. And she plays the diggeridoo. Yeah. Y'all want to know, she might do it for you. We'll see. We'll see. Without you hearing any more from me, I want to introduce you now to Vivian Q from Hilton Head, South Carolina.
Hi, everybody. My name is Vivian, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. And there's all kinds of stuff up here. I'm going to have to move a few things around. It's okay. Am I to leave this up here, or is that important?
Yes, it is.
Is this my timer? Oh, honey, I just want to say I'm looking out here, and it just blows me away. I'm just like moved to tears. I want to thank y'all. Thank you, Gene, for inviting me to come here. It's, again, you're going to hear a lot of repetitions, and that's all I know. I just say what I hear, and I've heard a lot of beautiful things here. Unfortunately, I forget most all of them, so I have to keep coming back so I can hear them again and again and again, because I still have that built-in forgetter. But I am so grateful to have been asked. Thank you, Gene. Thank you, everybody here at Any Links, and thank you, God. And it's only through God's grace, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'm standing up here before you sober today since January the 3rd, 1991. By God's grace. Now, I'd like to tell you that I was clean and sober for all those years, but I was not. And I was, you told me to do a couple of things when I got here. And I did none of those things. I don't know if any of you newcomers might can identify with that. I imagine. Because, you know, we get here and we're a little defiant and we're a little belligerent and contemptuous and, a little ego problem. And, we just don't want to be here and we don't want to be one of you and we don't want to be like you either, because if you can't handle your stuff, that means I'm in the wrong company, and here I am right in the middle of you. And it, just for the newcomers, just keep coming back. I was told by somebody who's sitting right over here today who's just come back into my life, who was one of those angels that was there when I first came into my very first meeting, and she used to say, "Don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle." And I was going, "What is she talking about?" And, and I just didn't want to be here. I just did not want to be here. Now, we don't get here by accident. Believe me, we are here because we are supposed to be here. And usually it's the last place on the block, But we don't know that. Thank God someone just said to me one day, "Would you like to go to a meeting?" And something happened. And I'm going to explain what happened as a result of my coming into the rooms and how I got here. But I want to tell you a little bit about some things. I was asked to speak a few years ago, and it was probably one of my first talks. And these are the kind of people I hang around. And I was telling this friend of mine how really nervous I was about getting up and talking in front of people. And I heard the story about the naked and all that. I always look at people and think that. So that's nothing abnormal for me. I have to try to clean it up now and put clothes on people. You know, and I'm sitting there and I'm telling people, you know, I'm just so nervous. And I don't know what she said. Vivian, just take a Valium. Oh, my God, Diane, I'm talking at an Alcoholics Anonymous group. I can't take a Valium, for God's sakes. And she said, well, just have a couple of martinis. They'll never know. You know, those are my best friends. Why not? You know, we like attracts like. And, you know, thank God I didn't do any of those things. But, you know, I was so grateful to come into the rooms and hook up with some of the winners in those rooms and by God's grace to stay in the rooms. I did none of the things you asked me to do in the very beginning. You told me to get a big book and get a sponsor and keep coming back and to do 90 and 90. And you just gave me all these orders. And I'm not good at orders, and I'm certainly not good at direction. And so, and then I forget half of what you tell me anyway because my mind is so fogged, you know. And it was just all I could do to just get in the rooms. And thank God the only thing I did right was the only thing that kept sticking is just keep coming back. Just keep coming back even if your ass is on fire. Just keep coming back. And I could grab onto that. I could see that. I could understand that. And thank you, I did keep coming back. It's the only right thing I did. And, you know, just keep coming back. Even if you mess up, it's okay. You're not looking at a bunch of people who are highly successful in life at doing the right thing. We get here not doing the right thing, and we're good at it. We're experts at it. We've perfected it. It got us in a lot of trouble, and we all pay the ultimate price to be here. And you know, and I'm not proud of all of that, but I'm by God's grace I can look at that now as we are not a glum lot, and I do not wish to shut the door on you know those dark and terrible and horrific things that we did in our past. Today is my greatest asset. And I hooked up with some people in the rooms, and I began to do some of the things you asked me to do. And, you know, for about 2.5 months, I could just do it. I kept coming, and you told me to go over there, and on the table was, you know, all this literature and these books and these pamphlets and stuff. And they, you know, said, make sure you get a big book before you leave today. And so before I left the meeting that day, I went over, and I got armloads of all this stuff. I got a big book and a 12 and 12, and I ripped them all off. I took them all. You know, I didn't pay for anything. I didn't realize that's what you're supposed to do here. I did make amends for that later on. It took a few years for that to surface. And trying to work an honest program. And you told me to get a sponsor. And you told me to do all these things. Well, I couldn't do that. You know, I didn't understand. I have so much more tolerance today with the newcomer because I know how it is. I've been there, done that. And the fog, God, it takes 30 days before you even know that you're sober. You know, and by then you're starting to go, where am I? You know, what in the world is going on? And it's just like shock sets in. You know, it's like trauma. I was traumatized. And then I sat around with like deer in the headlight looks for about the next 2.5 years. It's no wonder after about 3 months sitting around here not doing any of the things you suggested me to do is I bellied up to the nearest sickest person in the rooms and off to do some of that non-addictive marijuana maintenance that you hear about in here. And that lasted for 2.5 years. And so as a result of that, you know, I was... I had come to a point, as some of you will know who also have participated in the non-addictive marijuana maintenance program, that, you know, after a while you smoke that stuff and then it quits working. I don't care how much you pay for it. Then you have to kind of like stop for a few days and then you can get high again. It's like, really? And you do that for a few days, and then it quits working again. You know, I could never count on that stuff. And so, but I did it, you know. And sitting right in these rooms, doing the things I'd always done, nothing had changed. And I'm continuing to have all those old ideas. I'm still operating from sick behavior. You know, I'm sitting right in here, and I'm, you know, like you don't know what we're up to. Let me tell you. We know everything you're up to. You don't even have to tell us anymore. We have been there, done that, got the t-shirt. It's like you can't bullshit the bullshitter anymore. You think you can, and boy, and here I am sitting right up in the rooms, right up front, dark glasses. Of course nobody knows what I'm up to. You can't smell pot. You know, and the only right thing I did is not drink, but I just immediately substituted something else for it. And what do we do? If we don't work this program, we're going to find something else, because when the going gets rough and my stomach starts to churn and it gets too tight and too hot and the thermostat gets turned up, I am going to find something for relief. I drank for reward and I drank for relief. And I drank for the effect. And everything else that I did, I believe for me, drugs are a part of my story. I did drugs alcoholically. If you put something in front of me, I don't care if it'll just fit somewhere, it'll go in. You know? I know you know what you're talking about here. God bless us. We're nut jobs, you know? And you know, I walked in here today and I'm looking around and I don't know hardly, well, most of you. And yet, I love each one of you because you're my people. I felt totally at home when I walked in here today. I came a couple months ago with Deborah, who is, oh my God, what a miracle. I know, I've seen the miracle in this kid. You know, I've seen her for years and years and years, and she would ask me to sponsor on different occasions for about 5 seconds. And then go on off and do her thing. And, you know, because if you don't want what we have and do what we do, you don't want to be with us. We're intolerable to be with when we're transcended and transformed into that fourth dimension. You can't hang there, you know, it's just impossible. And poor Deborah, she'd go get another pill and another doctor, and she would keep, but the only thing she did right was she kept coming back. God bless her, she kept coming back. She could see, you know, something inside of us, because, you know, we have that beautiful, you see the eyes, see, I see it in your eyes. I can't see it as well as in mine, but I can see it in yours. I see the miracle. I see the clear eyes. I see that light around each one of you that you can't see yourself, but I can see it in you. And when Deborah came back about 7 months ago, I saw somebody I didn't even recognize. I didn't know who that was. I saw the outside person, but that person was completely changed. She had had that transformation. It was a miracle. And she's on fire with this program, and she's enthusiastic, and she's got a passion for staying sober and for helping others. Oh, my God, isn't that what we do? This is a miracle. Thank you, God. Thank you, Annie Lakes. Thank you for bringing the life back to this woman. She's on fire, and I'm just so excited to be a part of that. And that's what we do here. And then I'm sitting over here, and I'm seeing a friend of mine I've drank and drugged with for so many years, and I just couldn't keep up the pace. And and God bless her, she hung out there for another 25 years. And here she is, and I see the miracle. I see the miracle already. She's got it. This is the first time I've seen her sober in 25 years. Whoo, Jan. God bless you. God bless you. And you know how these miracles happen is that one alcoholic help another alcoholic. We don't even know what we're doing. And it's just that we are here and we're helping each other, and we get to stand up and stand tall and hold our head up and be clear and conscious and proud of who we are again. We get to have that self-respect and that self-esteem, and we get to help others to get out of ourselves and that selfish, self-centered, self-seeking self that we are, and go out there and offer a hand to somebody else we love so much and watch them start to walk the walk. What a beautiful thing. Thank God. Well, let me tell you how not to do the program. I'm really good at that. That's how I do life, is I mess up and I screw up, and then I learn, okay, well, we don't want to do that anymore. And so I came in here, and I was told to do these things and get a sponsor. And for 2.5 years, of course, I didn't do that because I was just too busy. And you're really busy when you're doing that, you know. And not only was I doing that, I was dealing in the rooms, and I was really cool, and I didn't think you knew anything, and you know everything, you know. And, you know, and after a couple of years sitting in the room, it just basically stopped working. It just stopped. And, you know, and I do want to continue that part of it, but I just remembered I forgot a whole other part of my life I need to catch you up on. I was born in Columbia, South Carolina, and I didn't know my father. He was a raging alcoholic who chose not to be a part of my life. And unfortunately, that's what we do. You know, probably that was the best thing he could do. I had a big resentment about that for years and years and years, and I just couldn't understand, how can you not be a part of your own children's life? You know, how can you do that? Don't you know the damage you do to people like me, and to people like you, and the people like that are to come? Don't you know what that does to us? And I was very resentful, and of course he ended up on my resentment list. But, you know, so I was born in Columbia. My mother left him as a result of, he was physically abusive and emotionally abusive to my mom, to the point that she had to flee for her life. And she had me in Columbia, South Carolina. I had a brother. I was later to have another sister by another man that my mother did not marry either. And back then, that was big stuff. So we were to come up with no dad. And, you know, I was born with a deformed stomach. And I was to be, out of the first 9 years of my life, in the hospital most of that time. And they put me on something called, early on, they prescribed something called paregoric. So at about the age of 6 weeks, I was to be given doses of paregoric in increments larger and larger as I got older, because you began to have an immunity to it, so it doesn't work, so they have to give you more for it too. And so they just kept me medicated. And I had the last rites 3 times during that time. And I remember the last time I was in the hospital, and they had all my family was around the hospital bed. I just came to at one point, and they were praying for me, and I was being anointed the last rites. And I remember them holding their hands and praying, and that's really all I remembered. And obviously I didn't do anything. I came out of that all right somehow, and got home, and that was the first. Now as I look back, always in hindsight, I recognize those miracles that occur in my life. And that would be one of the big ones right there, is I was able to come home and resume some type of normal life, which I had not had up to that point. And so, you know, I was able to go to public school, and I was able to do things that normal kids did. I continue to have stomach problems. Up until the last few years of my life, I've had severe stomach chronic problems. And today, I'm doing all right, you know. I'm doing pretty good. Physically, I'm amazed after what all I put myself through. And I think that I had such a high tolerance for pain, I could stay out there so long doing the things I was doing and not realize the havoc I was wreaking on my body, because I'm a real alcoholic. I don't know when I take the drink what I'm going to do. I drink for effect, and I could have one or two drinks one night and not come home the next. You know, I'd start off with good intentions, and I'd go maybe not have a drink tonight, and the next night I'd have 20, or and then I have 2 drinks and I'm over at the dealer's. And so I can't guarantee my behavior after the first drink. I didn't know that was the one I had to watch out for. Not the 10th, not the 7th, not the control. That never worked. But anyway, you know, I lived in Columbia for quite a few years until I was to grow through junior high school and high school. I married a man right out of high school who was 12 years older than me, who really, I look back now, was more like my father figure, but who could take care of me, and he adored me. He treated me like a princess. And I was to be in this sort of, I'm looking out here at this white picket fence. We didn't have one, but, you know, it's kind of like in my mind. That's what I think it was like, you know. And I was later to have 2 beautiful children. Todd Anthony, who's in my life today as a result of this program, but and a beautiful daughter. And, you know, if you would have thought that it would have been the most perfect family situation, and there was something restless, irritable, and discontent within me that I could not like who I was and where I was and what was going on in my life. And I was to spend the next few years in total misery. I wanted to die, or I wanted him to die. And I just kept imagining that if that would happen, that would make me happy. I just didn't know what was wrong with me, and I didn't know how to fix it. And I began to drink. I began to drink more on a regular basis. And, you know, it came a time in my drinking career that, you know, it's like I began to, I can only say it like this, my living conditions had deteriorated faster than I could lower my standards. I began to go out and do things that I had not done before just to escape. And you put the drink in me and anything goes and everything's all right. You know, I'm a blackout drinker. I didn't know that. I mean, we really don't know what we're doing. That's why they call it a blackout. But I had well-meaning people in my life who would tell me a few things. And, you know, and I didn't drink that much. I don't drink any more than anybody else, you know, and I had all these excuses, and I just continued to live in that delusional world for years, and my drinking began to be progressive. At some point, I made a decision that the only way to stand this insanity was to get out of this marriage. And as simple as getting up one morning and brushing my teeth, I made a decision to walk out on that marriage and those two beautiful children. That easy. Wasn't difficult. Packed my little bag, walked out the door. They were with, you know, my mom or somebody. I couldn't even tell you who I left the kids with. And by then I was in the grips of a disease I really couldn't understand. And, you know, I could justify it by saying, you know, I did the only right thing for those kids by not taking them through the trenches I was to engage. And that's, and today I'm glad I didn't. I see what happens when we do that. I see the, you know, there's a place in the big book where it talks about the warped lives of blameless children. And it's horrible. And it's about terror. And it's about fear. And it just breaks their little helpless hearts. And we do that time and time again, and we have those promises, and we swear we're never going to do this again, and I'm going to be a good parent, and I'm going to be there for you, and I can't do it. And my husband eventually did the only right thing that he could do, is he divorced me. And rightly so. And why, I don't understand, but he gave me joint privileges so I could come over and have visitation and do these things on a regular basis. And you know what? I couldn't keep it. I couldn't do it. I'd make promises and I couldn't keep them. And it began to be longer and longer periods of time between when I could be there and when I could. And I just basically quit going because I would swear that I'd be there and I'd go out and have a drink and I'd never go pick them up. They'd be waiting. I'd never come. That's what the disease of alcoholism does to parents. That's what the disease of alcoholism, and you know, and I had thought when I knew all this about my father, who was never present in my life, I never wanted to be like that man. I never wanted to be anything like him. And you know what? Years later, I look back, I had become just like that man. I didn't go out and physically brutalize people, but I emotionally did the damage. And my children, you know, God knows that my children's problems probably did have my name on them. And thank God for these rooms, because they've taught me that their solutions have their name on them. Thank you, God. And so, you know, I had reached a point in Columbia where I lived that I, you know, we do those geographics, and it had come to a point where I needed to get out of town, and I had the opportunity to move, and so what we do is, you know, we go get our stash and have a couple sick cooler full of this and that and whatever other paraphernalia you need, and then you pack. And I'll go down to the local U-Haul at place, and I go to get a truck, and the guy throws open the back end of this. You know, I can't get a little truck. I got to get a big truck. And I don't really need a big truck, but, you know, more is better. So I go over there, and I said, no, let's get that one. And he throws up the back, and there's an old bum in the back there, you know, and he's sleeping in there all night long. And I said, I'll take him, too. And so I bring him right along up front with me, and we fire one up, and off to Hilton Head we go. I don't know who this man was. God only knows he could have been anybody. Thank you. You know, I've been protected so much. I mean, I've been in some horrendous places, let me tell you. So we get down to Hilton Head and move in, and I'm always looking over my shoulder, and I'm hanging out with some pretty crusty guys, and to say the least, and, you know, and some of them are Colombians. And, you know, at one point, I'm partying with a group of people, and we spent a weekend together on this. You know, these people were like, they had stuff. And they were driving Mercedes, and they were renting, you know, now I look back on it how insane it was. They're renting houses. They never own anything. They're renting cars. They can't get one. Nothing can be in their name because they're all aliases. And they're all criminals, probably, too, you know. And partying with these guys, and oh, my God, you know. And I hear the next weekend that all of them were machine gunned down somewhere down in Florida. The same three guys I was hanging out with. These are the close encounters that happened to me in my life and my drinking, you know. You know, even in Colombia, I began to just live in total fear. And I was so used to, you know, my husband now had his whole family came from a law enforcement. We had guns everywhere, you know, so I knew how to use a gun, and I used to carry a gun. And you know, recently I went to look for it, and I don't even know where I had to go look for it. I couldn't find it. Now, that's progress. We're talking 40 years of packing here. I was sitting in some of the first meetings I ever went to in Hilton Head, and I carried a gun in my, I didn't carry a purse, I carried a holster. And they make them like purses now, because you can just pull your, if you have to have a shootout in the produce section, you're ready. I was just prepared. By the time I came to you, I was carrying a .357 Magnum on a regular basis. Now, and I had a lot of knives, and, you know, I don't know why. I think back, why did I have so many? I just didn't need that many. One, but no, more is better, you know. So that's the kind of craziness. And we don't see anything wrong with that kind of crazy crap we do out there. And we're dangerous. We're dangerous to ourselves and to others. We should all be locked up. You know, to the world out there, we look pretty good. Look at us. We clean up pretty well. They only knew. And it's just amazing. I remember picking up my sponsor. I want to tell you how there's a couple of things you need to do. My sponsor told me to be a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a couple of things you need to do. You need to have a home group. You need to have a sobriety date. And you need to have a sponsor. And thank God today I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. I come from some strong big book thumpers. And they don't take any crap, I want to tell you. They certainly, and I love them, they don't co-sign my bullshit. I don't want anybody to pat me on the back and tell me it's going to be all right, because it is not going to be all right. Don't tell me it's going to be all right. Show me what to do. And that's what I do with my girls. I don't sit back and tell them, just keep coming back, honey. That kills us. We can't wait. Please, dear God, don't do that. Get them in the book. Get them into the solution. I think Bill Wilson was once asked, what's the definition of the big book? And the big book, and I want to read this because I don't want to screw it up. Because I will. Bill Wilson said, the big book is designed to transmit the truth. and a spiritual experience to a reader who knows nothing about what is contained in this book. Isn't that beautiful? You know, we're miracles as a result of that book. Thank God. But you know, I don't even know where I was going with that anyway. So I was in, you know, I got to Hilton Head and One Piece and a lot of other stuff, and I was always looking over my back, and I was beginning to, you know, have papers try to be served on me and stuff. And if you're like the real alcoholic, you're always looking over your shoulder, and I couldn't have a phone in my name, and I, you know, lots of things like that. You know, and then the trail just follows us wherever we go. And I moved down there, and I began to meet people. And of course, we meet people. We find our kind, don't we? Like attracts like. So I get out there, and I'm hanging with these people who are doing those things. And I began to look at them as they have the power. And so I start doing some of the things they're doing. They're making a lot of money doing this, so I want to do that. And so I start dealing this and dealing that, and before you know it, I'm right up there with some of them, you know, doing the deal. I'm sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, not working the steps. Now I'm doing that non-addicting marijuana maintenance program, and I'm dealing right in the rooms. How sick is that? And that, you know, that shenanigans didn't go on too long, because, you know, some of you, you knew what I was up to. And you call me on my stuff. And after a few years of that, I couldn't stand myself anymore, and that stuff wasn't working for me anymore. And I finally hit square, you know, you're square with that decision. I had to fully concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic, and now what are you going to do about it? I believe it's my responsibility for actions past and present. If I'm an alcoholic, what am I going to do about it? And so thank God I had people put in my life that began to give me a set of directions. And after about, to go back to my sobriety date, I changed my sobriety date from 1991 to 1994. Because I couldn't remember if it was 2 years or 2.5 years, so I knocked off 3 years just to make the difference up. So that I could, you know, I was told if I wasn't clean and sober, then I wasn't sober. And so I finally started, you know, and you don't know what you don't know until you know. You can't know anything if your mind is all full of all this crap. And I had all that going through my brain from the time I was born until I got to you. And then you told me I needed to clean up and show up and suit up. And I believe today that as a result of this program, you would be looking at somebody else up here if it hadn't been for this program. Because people like me who do the things that I was doing usually die out there. And I was to have a few more of those experiences as a result of my shenanigans. And so I can tell you how not to do this program. And you can die out there not doing the things we ask you to do. I'm so proud to be a part of this community tonight, because I see what it does. It produces miracles. All you have to do is just do the work. You don't have to think about it too much. As a matter of fact, it's better if you don't think. Your best thinking got you here. Do us a favor. We don't want to know what you're thinking anymore. And we're not interested in your ideas or your decisions. I love it when they call and tell me, I've been thinking, I'm going, oh God. You want to know how to just disengage that business? When your sponsee calls you and said, I've been thinking, just say, well, do a four-step around it and call me. They never call you back. You know, but doing the work here is not as hard. It's so simple. I was talking to my sponsor about how, you know, it was Bill, as soon as Bill got out of the hospital, man, he was on it. Within a week, he was working with others. 2 weeks, I think he was talking to Dr. Bob, if I'm not mistaken. Dr. Bob was right in there and right on it when he got going on it, too. So it doesn't take but just a few weeks to do these things. All you have to do is just sit down and take direction and do the work. And miracles happen. And we have that uncanny ability to and unique opportunity to pass this along to others, you know, where nothing else has ever worked. you know, we do walk hand in hand with the good doctors and all that, but well-meaning doctors are killing us out there with pills. Let me give you a pill for that. Let me give you a pill for this. Before you know it, you're half dead by the time you, if you ever get here. And I'm one of those that don't believe that you take pills unless you just have a chemical dependency, that you have to be treated by that. Otherwise, I know what drugs do to people. And I've seen what happens as a result of that, and I've seen what happens when they can finally come off of that stuff. And I'm not saying that that's for everybody, but I would bet that a lot of alcoholics are misdiagnosed here. So I believe you have to work with a doctor, but you also need to find a doctor who's a recovering doctor if you can. Because I believe that probably 80% of us could come off of those drugs and work these steps. And if you have that spiritual awakening when you straighten out, see, we suffer from a spiritual malady. So if I'm suffering from a spiritual malady, the only thing that's going to set that right is a spiritual solution. And the 12 steps is precisely clear-cut directions to have that spiritual awakening. All you have to do is just take direction. Find somebody who has done the work, who's talking about the steps, sit down with them and take directions. Don't think about it. Dear God, don't think about it. You can die thinking about it. But anyway, I'm off that bandwagon now. So. You know, as a result of those steps, I've had a tremendous change in attitude towards God, towards others. And you know, one, the hardest thing for me to accept in my life was to have that new attitude towards myself. To forgive myself for the things that have happened in my life as a result of my alcoholism. And those days that I used to not go pick up my children, and there were many, and towards the end, I didn't go at all. And, you know, I'm not proud of that, but I today have a different way to live my life. I've been shown how to live my life today as a result of this program, and I was able to make amends to all those people on my list. You know, and we have, you know, it's just so simple. The first three steps are just decisions. It's not difficult. It's not hard. Just make the decision and move forward. And for me, if I do anything, if you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, I go through this thing, I do everything in turbocharge mode. So by the grace of God, I had somebody work with me on that level. And I was able to just plow through that stuff and have that spiritual awakening. And it's guaranteed. It's not even a suggestion or a promise. It's absolutely guaranteed. Read on page 83 and 84 the promises. That stuff really happens. It's not just fantasy. It's real stuff. It does happen. Trust me, because I was an alcoholic who couldn't think, I just couldn't think I would ever get this thing. And by the grace of God, I got it. One day I'm sitting at the Yana Club over in Hilton Head, and after up to 4 years of that's about how much progress I made in 4 years. And out of my, you know, this is God's working in my life. I get up to go get a cup of coffee. Now, these are some of the things I don't let my girls do anymore. I did everything wrong. I think it's really rude and disrespectful to get up and down when there's a meeting in progress. I don't allow my girls to do that. I say, if you've got to wear Depends, do it. If you've got... If you want coffee, get two or three or a thermos, bring it to the table. Because what happens when somebody gets up and you're at a meeting and they go walking over here? And I'm off wondering what they're up to. And then I'm looking at their clothes. And I'm wondering who they're with. And I've just missed about 10 minutes of 1 hour that's designed to save my life. And we just treat this thing like it's just no big deal. 1 hour I have in those rooms to hear the message. And I'm worried about what you're doing. And then the next one gets up and goes over here. So what I had to do when I got here is I had to come up with some rules for myself. I have attention deficit disorder. Good Lord, this morning was just a three-ring circus going on in my house, and it was just me. And that's on any given day. I called my son to tell him he left his safety glasses at my house. He said, "What are you doing, Mom?" And I said, "Well, I'm packing. I just put in a load. This is at 6:30. I just put in a load of clothes. I'm dyeing my hair. I can't go there with roots. I'm cleaning out the bottom of my closet because I have to find this one pair of shoes that I really don't need to wear right now because it's not snowing outside, but I gotta find them. All of this is at 6:30 in the morning. Then I have about three or four other things. He's going, whoa, moms, take a breath. God, you know, if you could just get it down to just a few things, it would be manageable. But and then I get to laugh about it. We laughed about it all the way up here. It's like the insanity is still there. It's just the difference today is I'm aware of it. And I have to stand back and go, oh, my God. You know, think about what other people are going through with me. But anyway, so, you know, where was I? I hate when I do that. Where am I? So anyway, I'm in the Yana Club, and I'm just so, you know, I'm so easily distracted, so I had to come up with some self-disciplines. You know, God works through us in such mysterious ways, but is constantly working with us if we're just present. And so I got this idea that what I had to do when someone was speaking is I had to really focus on what they were saying. Not just listen, but I had to, like, look at their mouth and watch it move and listen to the words. And then when the person started sharing over here, I needed to change my position and watch that person. And if they started sharing over here, then I would do it that way too. And I began to hear the message. I couldn't hear the message until I learned how to listen. I never knew how to listen. I never got that in all my years of school. Did anybody tell you how to listen? Heck no, they told me to shut up. And so I would just, that's how I taught myself to listen to you. It's God speaks through you. Okay, I'll see you out back. But you know, so I began to do that. I quit getting up and down during the meeting because I was one of those people. I was getting up and getting down. I didn't get one cup of coffee. I probably got three or four. And back when they were smoking in the rooms, oh, and then I was all busy in that. Just busy, 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 busy. We have 1 hour. Just one. One in 24. And I am running around like a BB on a plate in 1 hour. How much do you think I'm getting? Not a lot. So when I began to do that, in a short span of time, I began to hear things I had never heard before, and I'm sure they were said, but now I began to hear them, and things began to get a little different. And I'm beginning to hear people share, because I'm really paying attention now for the first time in my life, and I'm beginning to hear them say things that really made sense. And there's a guy that just happened to come to Hilton Head, and he became known as the four-step guru. And I'd seen a few people attempt to do that. Mostly, all I heard back then was people complaining about this, that, or the other person. I didn't hear a whole lot about the big book. Now, that's really not true, but that's what I thought was going on. See, we have a disease of perception. If any of you have not heard Clancy Eyes tape, Alcoholism, a Disease of Perception, I encourage you to get that tape. It just blew my mind. Incredible information. It tells us basically that we're all nuts. What I think you're saying and what you're actually saying sometimes are two different things, even today. And thank God the difference in how I assess things today is I think I know what you're saying. And then I give it a few seconds. And if nothing outrageous happens, I think it's probably the right thing. And then, you know, it's that little gift in time between thought and that gift of awareness and reaction. My reaction time is slowed down considerably as a result of this program, thank God. And so now I get to really kind of assess what you're saying because I listen more to what you're saying. And you know, I try to keep a lot of my thinking out of it still. I just try to hear what your words are. I try to meet people where they are today. What are you trying to tell me? If I can just shut up and listen, I'm going to be amazed, and I usually am. Thank you. You've taught me how to do that. And so And you get a chance, I'm sure Gene has that tape here. You guys listen to that. It just changed my life. And so now I'm listening at meetings, and there's this new guy there, and he's telling me, you know, he's talking all about the fourth step, and I really am not interested, and I'm busy, and, you know, and I'm doing all these things we really should not be doing because it's so disrespectful, because we only have this 1 hour. For God's sakes, try to pay attention. It's not easy. Tall order. And so it's a discipline, and I learned how to do that, and I started listening to Dick Jay start to talk about the fourth step and how he had gone through it. And I began to see a couple of people that he had taken through this fourth step. And I literally saw people transform before my eyes. It's almost like they were speaking in tongue. They began to act differently. They had this aura about them that it was like nothing I'd ever experienced before. And you know, my curiosity got up a little bit. And one of these days, you know, sitting in there, getting up and down, oh, I got to go to the bathroom, oh, I got to do this, and I wanted to tell her, we got to go to lunch, we got to, you know, what are they wearing, who's that, what are they up to? It's crazy. And one of these days, I get up to go to the kitchen to get another cup of coffee. And I literally run flat out into Dick Jade. I mean, literally bounced off each other. And I, out of my mouth, fell the words, nothing was planned here. Will you help me with my fourth step? And I sort of like go, who said that? Because I didn't really want to do that yet. You know, I don't know what I was thinking, but I just didn't think I wanted to do that yet. And clearly it's God working in my life. And Dick had been watching me, you know, the previous years, and he'd grabbed me by the hand. He said, after this meeting, you and I are going to sit down by that pew. We have a pew at the Yana Club that we inherited from some church somewhere. And I can't tell you, probably tens of thousands of third step prayers have been knelt by and said right on that pew. And that day, Dick did that with me. And I believe that's when my recovery started. I had already put down the junk, and now I'm just on autopilot. It was a good time for me to start doing something here, and I think God seized the moment. Put Dick in my life and took me through the big book, and in that day, after going through several pages in the big book, pointing out and reading together certain things, I left from there and went home and took those directions simply because I didn't have any more plans. And I was at that jumping off place. I was either going to drink again, and to drink again for me would surely mean to die. Because, you know, for drinking for me is to take me back out there, and I know I have another drunk left in me, but I don't know if I have another recovery in me. I don't want to take any more chances, because I tell you now, as a result of doing that fourth step, I have the evidences in, and I don't want to be that person ever again. The damage I did is irrevocable. I can't change any of that. But I have changed that person, because today I'm no longer that person, and I can be the mom. I can be the daughter. I can be the wife. I can be the sister. I can be the friend. You know, I can be another alcoholic and help another alcoholic. None of those things I knew anything about until I got here, and you taught me how to do those things. So I went about the business of doing this work, and I went home that afternoon, and Dick said, you go home, you say the third step prayer every time you work on this step work. If you get interrupted, you say the third step prayer again. You re-engage. That is your connection with God. I don't want you thinking here. You've been thinking far too long and far too much. It didn't get you anywhere. I want God to think for you for a change. Do this as I tell you, and God will give you this list. See, I've been trying to do this thing by myself, and I could get 3 or 4 names. But when I asked God to help me do this, I went home within 15 or 20 minutes, I had over 100 names on my list. I remember starting to write, and I don't even remember writing. And when I got done, I looked at my watch, and only about 20 minutes had gone by, and I had over 100 names, and for me, that was huge. These were people that went back through my entire life. And that was pretty freaky. And I get on the phone with us, you're not going to believe what just happened. Dick knew that that's what happens here. If we just do the work, if we do the work well, things happen. God doesn't make too difficult for those things that we seek if we just do the work well. Something like that. I'll keep coming back. But anyway, so I did the list. And then he gave me clear-cut directions. He didn't make it too terribly difficult. He says, call me every day. We will have an assignment every day. You do the list today. Call me. I'll give you the next assignment. Column 2. What's the resentment? You see, the fourth step is our key to the rest of our life. You take the fourth step and the evidence. For the first time in your life, you see the truth of who you are and what you've been up to. And oh my God. And all those things you think are your deepest secrets that you'd never tell anybody. There they are, black and white. And they're not pretty. Because none of us get here. I mean, we're not talking about the good things. Surely all of us have good things in us and we've done good things. We don't need to fix those. We need to fix the things that are killing us. We need to fix the things that are killing others. Because that's what we do out there. We take hostage. We do damage. It's destruction to you and to me and everybody I know when I'm out there doing the things I do. So I get about the business of calling Dick every day, and I'm doing the directions every day. Don't ask me why. It just seemed like a good idea. Now all of a sudden, now I'm done. And when you get to the fourth column, you've seen a big chunk of truth and you go, oh my God. That's when the work starts right there. Don't stop there. Don't stop. No matter what, just keep plowing ahead. Dick was to leave after that time. It's a bad place for this alcoholic to have all this information and nowhere to do it. Nobody to give it to. He left, and in the interim, my current sponsor happened to come to the island. Now, I'm still the newcomer, so to speak, because, you know, I've been in the rooms for 4 years. I still don't know what the heck I'm doing because I'm just a few months off the other stuff. And thinking clearly is not one of my greatest attributes. So, I was asked to be a hostess for a speaker coming in, but no one really ever told me what to do, so I didn't do anything. I didn't call her, I didn't go pick her up, I didn't offer to help, I didn't... Tell us something, guys. Don't expect us to know what these things mean. I don't know what hostessing means. So anyway, she was a kind and gentle person. And she says, oh, you're my hostess. I said, well, that's what they tell me. Anyway, I meet this woman, and she's just incredible. And I identified so much with her story. Now, she came from a different part of the country, and she has a completely different story, but I could identify with those feelings. Those feelings of not good enough, not equal to, not good as, or better than. God, how do you do all that? I know. And so, you know, it's just real confusing most of the time. But we think we know what we're doing. So anyway, I'm talking to her, and she says to me, do you have a sponsor? And I'm going, a classic statement, I'm thinking about it. So she only said about 16 more times, you really do need a sponsor. And I told her where I was at, and so she gave me a bunch of cards and said to call her, and she lives out of town. And so I really didn't think I was going to have to do anything because I didn't think she was going to say yes because she lived so far away, and I figured that was an easy out for me. Now, see, here I am sitting on all this information, and I'm starting to ease my way right on out the door again. That's how quick the insanity returns. And so anyway, I call her, and will you be my sponsor? She says, yes, honey. So she tells me I got to come up and see her in Augusta, and that's about a 3-hour trip from me, and I get going, and I'm, you know, and I got my gun, and I got my knives, got my four-step. We're on the road, me and all these committee meetings going on in here. And good Lord. And so I get up there, and I give her my fifth step, you know, and it was just priceless. And I go through all these things, and, you know, and she just had me read everything that was on my list. And so when we get done, you know, we go down the list, and the first two people on my resentments were God and my daughter. And then I had me on there somewhere too. And she said, you have to put yourself on there, so I did that. But I was very resentful because when I was in Colombia, I went to pick up my children one time. This has just happened to be one time that I did show up. And I went to pick up my kids, and my son had a baseball game, and he couldn't go, and my daughter came with me. And her name was Katina Teresa. And so I was to take her for the day, and we went up to the lake to be with some of my other friends who had a daughter the same age. And we get up there, and we hung out the day, and yes, we were drinking, and yes, we were doing drugs. And you don't think, you know, I didn't do a lot. I didn't think it was any big deal. And we get in the car to come home, and there's an accident. And my daughter dies in the accident. And I was in the hospital for quite a long time myself. The car turned over on top of me, and everything from the waist up was crushed. And I was hemorrhaging at one point, and they didn't know where from, so they opened me up, and because all my lungs were collapsed because of the ribs had gone through the lungs, and they began to do the incision, and I was conscious of that. I could feel it. And I remember being up over the operating table looking at my body, and it was just a far-out experience. And I don't remember anything after that. I woke up several days later, I guess, in ICU, and I was to stay there for quite some time. And I was to get the last rites one more time. So consequently, I didn't go to the funeral, and I didn't participate in any of that. And, you know, it was... You know, I was just on so many drugs when I was in the hospital. I couldn't do anything, but I can tell you what I did do. You know, it would be 17 more years that I drank with a vengeance after that. And I was convinced it was nothing more than an accident. And I never went to the funeral, of course. I wasn't able to, but I never went to the grave. I couldn't bring myself to go there. Could not face that. I hardly talked to my son after that. Poor guy, little guy had to go to counseling after that. And of course he would. I didn't speak with any of my family for years after that. I was brought up on manslaughter charges. So you see the devastation we cause, and we don't think so. How many times did I drive with my kids in the car? Totally messed up. And never anything happened. But here's this 1 inches in seconds, and the most devastating thing that could happen to a mom. So I'm doing my fifth step with Michael now, and we're on step 6 and 7. And we're making our list in step 8. And she tells me that I have to make amends to my daughter, that I was responsible for that accident that took her life that day. And I said, how do you do that? How do you do that? And she said, you don't have to do any of this alone. I will walk through this with you, hand in hand. She said, you'll write a letter, and we'll take it to the grave, and you'll read that letter to your daughter. And that's how you'll make amends. And I was so afraid. I was in such shock that the reality of that truth finally was revealed, that I didn't want to drink anymore. I wanted to die. I didn't want to live another minute. And Michael knew that. She hardly let me out of her sight. It was very shortly after we went to the grave, and it would be a day in the summer, and it was extremely hot. And it's in Elmwood Cemetery in Columbia, and it was extremely, I mean, I'm talking, it was 105 degrees that day, and we were sweating profusely. And it was on a weekend. There was no one there that I could even ask where would the grave be. So we had to look for it. And that took us about an hour and a half, and we found the little plaque with her little name on it. She would have been 9 years old. And so Michael says, you know what? And this, I had 4 years sobriety at this point. I had a 4-year coin. And she said, all you have to do is bury your chip. And I couldn't think. I was just following direction at this point. And I had written a letter. And I always like to read that letter whenever I share this story. And then I have a poem I like to read as well, because someone else who had the same tragedy as me wrote a beautiful poem for both our daughters. And I'd like to read that for you as well. Dearest Tina, I'm so proud to tell you, but you probably already know, that I've been sober in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for 4 years. I'm so sorry it took me so long to take these actions. I want to make amends for my actions as an irresponsible, undependable, and absent mother. I am responsible for your death. And I am eternally sorry. I love you with all my heart, and I promise I will use this tragedy to help others and hopefully prevent other tragedies like this from happening. I embrace you, and I love you, Mom. Now, I want to tell you, as I began to read this letter, some incredible things began to happen, things that I really wish I could explain to you, but there are no words to explain what was going on around me. Michael is standing right beside me, and I'm reading this letter, and it was very hot this day, and there was enormous sweat just pouring off of us. There was no winds, there were no clouds, and the minute I started reading this letter, an incredible wind engulfed and started circling around us. It cooled us immediately. Our hair was standing straight back. I didn't know really what was going on. And I grabbed Michael and I was holding on because I was scared to death, because I really couldn't understand this. I know today I was right in the middle of a huge spiritual experience. I saw the light. I felt the presence of my daughter, and I felt the presence of God. I had had a real problem with religion and with God for a long, long time, and I had always felt very comfortable with Native American spiritual belief system, and so I had adapted that into my life. As I read this letter, an eagle was circling right over my head. And the minute I stopped reading that letter, that wind went away and the heat returned, and we began to sweat profusely again. I took Michael back to the car, and I decided that I would return to the gravesite because I had never really been there, and I wanted to have communion with my daughter for the first time. And for the first time in many, many years, I could literally cry. I had never mourned that death. And I'm sitting there, and I have a skirt on, and I'm just sitting on the ground, and my daughter spoke to me. She said, "Mom, I have a life today, and so do you. Now go on out there and live it." And it would be literally years before I understood that message. Today I know exactly what that message is. It's the message of life. It's the message of recovery. It's a message of hope and of faith and of love. And I'm sitting there totally in shock from this experience, and a little ladybug lands on my skirt. And now I'm looking at the ladybug, afraid to move because I don't know what's going to happen next. And she speaks to me one more time. Just a short, simple little statement. "Mom, that's one of my favorite little creatures." So I wear the ladybug in her memory. And I started the year after that, I started the ladybug retreat as a living memorial and a living amends to my daughter. And we had our 11th year last year. And I invite each and every one of you, sorry guys, women, start your own, to please come and participate in one of the most beautiful experiences I've ever had in my life, is to watch women find a place where they can bring their stuff and they can talk about anything. And we talk about emotional sobriety, and we talk about intimacies and relationships and how to do all those things through the 12 steps of recovery. I want to read one more poem that came along after a few, like a year after Michael started talking about this, and she's a speaker, so she started talking about this in her leads all over the country, and a woman heard her tape and she wanted to get in touch with me, so she wrote a poem and she sent it to me. It's called The Ladybug Experience. It's about her daughter and my daughter and our sobriety. There's a little 9-year-old girl up in the sky. She holds my baby between her legs on a swing of silver lace clouds. Her arms clasp around her waist so she won't slip. My baby's downy hair tickles her nose, but she keeps on singing sweet lullabies and tells her stories of ladybugs and fireflies. She tells her what it's like to go to school, something my baby never got to do. She tells her she wasn't sure if Santa Claus was real. My baby seems to know what she means as she giggles and squeals, and then she spoke of her mother with the warmest sound, and the baby of mine, she looked around, and their eyes met, and they knew the same disease had brought them there. An illness so ugly it didn't care that their mothers loved them so dearly and would have died in their place. How they wished and prayed to see their faces just one more time and to smell their smell. To let them know that now they were well. The disease had retreated after quite a fight. One day at a time, they win this war. The little girl whispered into my baby's ears as they swung even higher into the clouds, and I know our mothers didn't want it this way, but I hope they know we have each other and that it's okay. You know, taking those actions in step 4 through 9 was absolutely the hardest thing I've ever done. But it was absolutely the best thing I've ever done. I've come to believe in a power that I can't see or feel or touch, but I have come to know a power greater than anything I've ever imagined. I have a benevolent God in my life that loves me and supports me and loves you and supports you. And we help each other like bookends. You helped me. When I came here, I got here, and I was filled with such shame and guilt and remorse and secrets that no one would ever know. And you held me up like bookends. And you taught me how to walk, stand tall and proud, and have self-respect again. I'm so grateful that I get the opportunity to share these things with you. And as a result of doing the step work, I have had a spiritual experience. I have had a spiritual awakening. And it is enough to transform me from the person I used to be to the person I am today. And that is far better than anything I ever imagined. I know that there's a powerful God who can take the worst thing I've ever done and allow me to use it as a tool to help others today. And that's a miracle. You offered me your hugs and your unconditional love. You took me in all my brokenness. And I feel whole again today. And I want to share with you one more thing, something that I recently came across that I absolutely love. And this is conference-approved literature, a member's eye view of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it talks in here about, there's a portion in the Gospel of Matthew which recounts that when John the Baptist was languishing in prison of Herod and asking the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, "Art thou he who is to come? Or shall we look for another?" And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, "Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear and the dead rise. The poor have the gospel preached to them," and back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in material sense, but the poor in spirit. So I can tell you only what I've heard and seen in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It seems that the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed and the deaf hear and the dead rise, and over again in the middle of the longest day and the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told them. God grant that this may always be so. Thank you for letting me share.